Electric bicycles are my jam. I'm turning into a nut for a good e-bike. It's easy to get around, we save gas not driving our car for short trips to the store, and I'm getting a little extra exercise. The folks at Velotrick are sponsoring a series of videos on my channel to show off some affordable e-bikes and help people get up to speed. It's easier than you think, and prices have never been more competitive. You can catch those videos on my YouTube channel, but if you're interested in shopping an e-bike, head over to velotrick.bike/somegadgetguy and look at their road bikes and fat tires. Again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy. If any of those bikes look good to you, you can save an additional $60 off an already low price by using the coupon code SOMEGADGET60, SOMEGADGET60 at checkout. Once again, VELOTRIC.BIKE/somegadgetguy and coupon code SOMEGADGET60. And I thank Velotrick for being a sponsor on this show. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, the SGG of this terribly named podcast. Or sorry, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy. Did I even make it to that part? I don't think I did. I just had to take a breath earlier than I thought I'd be able to. Some Gadget Guy is the SGG part. The QA is what we're really here for. Obviously stands for question and answers. We chat out some of the more interesting tech news stories from the last week. That's why I like to hold my podcast on a Monday, get everybody up to speed, kind of sort out our feelings, not just by reading the headlines on social media, but following up on these stories as they evolve over time. And maybe some news broke over the weekend. We had a breaking story just shared by Dave Burns over on the Discord, which is making our lineup today. I'm already seeing a great crew here in the chat who helped me sort of troubleshoot some audio. Kapakash, we've got Fat Produce, we got Bray Gray, Mind Your Helm, Lampros, Goat V8, and Jman150, Simon Says Hypno. We are ready to go. Hope everybody had a lovely weekend. This weekend we had lots of baseball and softball activities. My daughter's is her first season playing softball, and we had a rain out. So this weekend we were supposed to have a bunch of games. Those games are going to have to be rescheduled, which is really dicey for a lot of the kids in their schedule and school and all that fun stuff. But our coach is awesome. So it's Saturday morning. The game got rained out, but there's this window of time where it's not raining. And she goes out of her way to call up the coach of the team we were going to play. And she puts out this last-minute blast. She's like, okay, if you all just meet us at the school baseball field, the coach of the other team says they're going to bring some girls, and we can just scrimmage. And it ended up being 6-on-6. So we had grown-ups in the outfield from both teams. And the girls were just playing infield and batting. And it was the most fun ever. It took me all the way back to like getting a sort of a stickball game going with friends just out at a field. No uniforms, no rules. You know, we were all kind of umpiring together. And it was just like weekend kid fun in the best possible way. And it's like, you have that realization. It's like, there are so many things that I think kids today get to grow up with that are really, really cool. And then there are a few things like, I don't think that happens anymore. I remember, because I grew up on military bases, I remember like, I would just go out to like one of the parks and we'd hold an impromptu kickball game. And you couldn't get more than like two innings before kids were arguing about rules or like, I'm going to take my ball and go home. And this is game over because you didn't let me do what I want to do. And like, that doesn't seem to exist anymore. So it was just really awesome. We had all these girls just like ready to play, and it was fun. And they were interacting with girls on the other team. And I don't know, it just felt like nostalgic. It felt anachronistic in a way. So anyway, and then later that night, we got to take Lex to her first Dodgers game. And she got to experience almost everything that you could experience in one Dodgers game, there was a rain delay, so she got to see like the crowd getting all antsy about whether or not they were going to play. She like lit up when the crowd started cheering when they pulled the tarp off the field. There was a fight. She did not like it when the dugouts rushed the field because there was like an altercation at home plate. She saw the Dodgers behind, then rally back. It was pretty great. She was sitting across the aisle from a Padres fan who was asked to leave by Dodger Stadium security. She also didn't really like that fellow in particular either. So it was a really lovely weekend. I hope everybody out there also had a really, really nice weekend. Bionic Scoop, you do need to get in the Discord. There's a fun kind of chill, just tech nerd. I'm trying to contribute a bit more. We do have one channel on the Discord that's like for fitness, and I have not been reaching my step count, but I am trying, so I'm trying to participate there. I also like to frequent the foodie channel on the Discord, because I very much enjoy people sharing photos of delicious-looking food. House of Bockley saying, hey everyone, hi Juan. And Dave Burns, this is like one of the things Marie and I were talking about. Dave says, not enough spaces for kids, and most kids don't live near parks anymore. And like, Dave, you would appreciate this because Marie brought it up in the context of late stage capitalism, because we were getting really lefto pinko commie. But she was just saying, like, there literally are no more places where a kid can go unsupervised and there isn't an expectation that they will spend a lot of money. And when the kids are a little younger, you also have to look out for other grown-ups that will narc on kids being unchaperoned. Where when I was Lex's age, I would just go outside and play and go to a park, and there was no geotagging or geofencing or lowjacking your kid. And I know there are safety concerns. I know we have better tools. I know parents have higher responsibilities than they did in the past, but then we also don't empower kids to take those opportunities to go do things. We live in a series of condos that have these like horseshoe-shaped parking lots, and one of them, they're older, they're like fourth and fifth grade, but a bunch of kids live in one parking lot a little too far away for Lex to just on her own go and play. But they are constantly outside in that parking lot, in that horseshoe, just playing outside all by themselves. And it's like that kind of thing. It's like that feels so rare these days. Let me get this out of the way here. Fat Produce, you should go to a Dodgers game cheering on the Deep Space Niners. I almost thought about wearing, because Fat Produce hooked me up, I have a Deep Space Niners ball cap, but I don't know. Well, there's also just a different vibe at Dodgers Stadium, because we haven't been there in years. It was actually Marie and I's first game back since before the pandemic, and there's a more aggressive vibe at Dodger Stadium than I remember. So I don't know how wearing another team's logo, even a fictional science fiction team, would have gone over in, you know, prime Dodgers territory. Yeah, Juice, this is totally true. Juice3250 says, probably depends on your neighborhood if you feel comfortable letting your preteen play outside unsupervised. And we live in a pretty nice little quiet suburb tucked away from main roads. We're actually, I don't know, I'd need to ask Marie what her concerns are, but I'm honestly a little more afeared of, like, rattlesnakes and coyotes than I am, like, other stranger danger-y kinds of things. When you guys see in some of my videos where I'm, like, outside or on kind of, like, one of those hilltops, man, there is a lot of wildlife out there. I am frequently seeing very large wild dogs like up the sides of those hills. For one of the bike videos that we did, there's a sequence where the three of us are, it's for one of the Velotrek videos, the three of us are kind of riding through some of the more of the horseback country, you know, hillsides and stuff like that. And on one of those rides where I was getting footage, it was just Lex and I had her out in front so I could kind of keep an eye on traffic coming up behind. And we took this little side route through horse trail, and it's super, super tall grass. And in one ride, a rattlesnake crossed our path. And then as we were heading back home, a coyote was standing in the middle of the horse path. And I'm like, okay, we could keep going. And Lex is very concerned. So she kind of instinctively just stops. And I stop behind her. And that dog doesn't move. That coyote is not intimidated by us at all. And so I get off my bike, I throw the kickstand, and I start walking towards it. And it moves with the most hilarious... I mean, at the time, I'm super anxious, because, like, I don't want to fight a coyote, but, like, you know, my daughter isn't going to be able to defend herself. This dog moved with the most hilarious apathy I think I've ever seen in an animal. So it's standing upright, I start walking towards it, and it, like, raises its head just a little, because it's, like, watching me. And as I get closer and closer and closer, I'm probably... I don't know. I want to say maybe 15 feet, 20 feet. I mean, I'm getting pretty close. And it does this thing where it had raised its kind of head up, and then it kind of like deflated a little and then slowly trudged off. I'm putting a lot of human emotion on this, but it was like a fine, I'll move kind of sigh from a very, very large wild animal. So it's things like that. We're constantly seeing the signs up in our neighborhood about missing pets. Not great. Oh, Michael Corcoran. I was trying to watch Juan's channel on Twitch, and I got sidetracked by a channel that shows a baby monkey eating watermelons and peppers. I feel in terms of just raw entertainment value, that's probably a more entertaining channel. So, you know. House of Ockley, Wile E. Coyote on the prowl. Only the coyotes out here are way more successful than Wile E. Coyote. Let me get this out of the way here. Okay, so we've got a really fun, interesting news-heavy block. As you might have noticed from last week, where we were, I really loved having TK on just to kind of chat out through some of these news articles and have someone to bounce this stuff off of. And then TK and I did our best of the week. We've got a lot of housekeeping to get through, but we're in just that little bit of a dip. This is kind of one of the interesting pacing situations this year, where phones designed to be sold in 2024, a lot of them launched at the end of 2023, and then companies like Samsung seem to have accelerated their release schedule to kind of keep up, so they're not left too far behind the Xiaomis and the Vivos. And now we got into April, and usually there's just like a bit more of a front load through MWC, but we got some of those really, really big announcements before even MWC. So we've had a little time to catch up. I've finally gotten a video out on some things like that laptop. I've got to talk about mini PCs. Had a really interesting call with a major manufacturer. They have no interest in sending me a phone, but their components side was like, hey, what if we talked about like graphics cards and monitors? And we're like, cool, let's do that. So you'll be seeing a variety of videos coming to the channel soon. I'm just under embargo on some really silly things. And I had to address, like, three videos have gotten tied up now on companies that have sent out pre-release or beta versions of their products. And, man, this slows me down. It slows me down like crazy. So it's really frustrating. I kind of keep this tier, this separation where if I call something a review, no financial incentive has been exchanged for producing that video. You might have seen on the channel, I've been trying to tackle a few more sponsored videos, and I feel good about separating out if something is called a review, that means this is my completely untouched opinion of the product. The manufacturer has had no say on the editorial. And then if something is a sponsored video, obviously I'm working with that company to tell a very specific kind of story, but I won't call that a review. It'll be an overview or something else, but we try to do something different. So I got products into review. Specifically, like the one where I've got a laptop here that was shipped with malware, that has to be a part of the story, right? That has to be a part of the conversation. And if it had been a sponsored video, well, I still would have felt like I have an editorial duty to my channel to mention this, and it would have probably destroyed the relationship. Even just mentioning it in the video that I did, I'm probably never going to get product from this company again unless we can work out, you know, some kind of conversation on how that coverage is going to go. So other products, though, have come in, and it's not fair to put out a video or review them saying, like, hey, by the way, this is totally broken, when they sent me something that wasn't going to be sold to consumers. But then I need to tell them, like, hey, if I talk about the product in this state, it's going to make your product look like hot garbage. But I had to go through the process of testing it, talking about it, one of them, I even got to the point where I'd shot my A-roll, and they were still coming back, oh, what if you tried this setting? Have you tried toggling this mode? What about doing a hard reset? And you're like, this is all time I can't spend trying to fix your product so I can make you look better. So it's been really frustrating. I've had three completely fall apart, two microphones and a portable monitor. And it's like, your product does not do what you say it does. Oh, but the retail release will. But I can't know that because you didn't send me that. So, let's work this out then. Can you send me a version that does the thing? Oh, well, we'll see about our supply. Okay, but if I go to publish this, I'm going to say it's totes brokes, guys. Oh, well, we shouldn't do that. So, thank you for wasting my time. So, where there would have been three more videos over the last 2 weeks, it's still like all that time was still taken up. So, it wasn't like you can just shift gears and put out a different video. I don't have a different video to put out. That time being the finite resource that it is, all that time went to something else. So, Simon says Hypno, Ace Magic, a.k.a. King Malware. House of Buckley, one has more embargoes imposed than North Korea. Oh man, jeez. And J-Man with the, I loved the podcast with Miriam. We're going to get into some housekeeping here, and that's one of the biggies is I always love, Tank Girl is just, she's just a machine. It's like, you've got to really kind of stay on your A game. Like, if I know I'm doing her show, I'm reading up on all the topics and like, you really got to stay on your toes. Cause if you don't pop in to interject, she's just going to roll right over you. If you can do a Tank Girl podcast, you can do anyone's podcast. So let me take a drink of coffee. We'll get into some housekeeping here.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
All right. Oh, I have not tested my screen share. Let's see if screen share is working right. Hey, there it is. So, the big video of last week, I finally publicly published the Ace Magic AX16 Pro laptop. It happened to me too. And the thumbnail has a big malware question mark on it. I'm going to spoil part of this video right now for you folks here on the podcast. The malware conversation is a totally separate conversation. It's the last part of the video. I hope you'll check out the review. But I wanted to talk about the nuts and bolts of the mini PC movement and why I've been excited about it. I don't know why my camera is like not keeping me centered. It keeps wanting to like put my hat above the frame. Anyway, so we've got a bunch of these like little mini PCs. I'm using three of them in my house now. For like, one is an emulation machine that's on my office TV. I'm still using that old Core ninth gen Nook as our gaming PC behind the living room TV. I'm using a headless unit as a Plex server. When you can get just like a cute little bucket of compute power, it is so fun putting those in different places. I think we're going to add yet another mini PC to our bedroom TV just because I like having a more proper computer to drive an entertainment experience rather than, like, even a Chromecast. Chromecast is kind of fun, but the customization and the capabilities of these little boxes are awesome. So I picked this thing up, and this is a little mini PC. This is another Ace Magic that I'll be shooting another video on that I'm not entirely sure the folks at Ace Magic are going to love. But this idea works really well. This is a 12th gen Core i9 laptop style chip, 12900H. This box is incredibly powerful, but a lot of things are kind of a little inexpensive. Like the plasticky material of this desktop PC, the component choices aren't exactly, you know, like gamer tier workstation grade, but it knows what audience they're trying to find. And also the software is rudimentary to the point where if you want to do things like tune your performance, you have this little rocker switch, like a power, like a turbo button on an old PC that controls your fans. If a fancy PC would have customizable fan curves and some kind of performance monitor in software that can handle all of this. No, here we have rocker switch. So this is really an inexpensive solution for someone who might target a higher performance mini desktop. But the thing is, you never pick this up. You never handle this. Once you set it up, plug in your monitor, plug in your keyboard, you hook it up to a nice screen, it's offering a premium computing experience for a lot less than a premium desktop would cost. I can't say the same. The strategy doesn't work as well when we're talking about a laptop. So that mini desktop, you take a two or sometimes three generational chip, you're really not going to feel a 2 to 3 generation deficit. You've got a performance per dollar, which is really attractive, and you're not handling what makes it feel kind of cheap. But when you do the same strategy with a laptop, so this is an AMD 5700U, this chip is still a great performer. It's got a decent little GPU on there. You can do some decent low-quality setting gaming on it. The screen is okay. It's a good LCD IPS, but going with the older chip here, it's harder to hide some of the cost savings on a laptop. Because even unless you've got this set up and docked so that it's basically a desktop, you're handling it, moving it around. You can feel sort of the plasticky chassis. You can feel where some of the pieces kind of rub. You know, you hear on seams, you can kind of feel the tray for the keyboard. It's sturdy, but it's got a bit of a dip to it, especially when you're in those middle keys and you have big, dumb, clumsy fingers like I do and you type kind of hard. So I don't feel this strategy works as well for laptops. Sell the older chip and build a less expensive chassis around that chip. I think that works incredibly well for desktops. I think the Geekoms and the B-Links and the Minis forums and, I mean, malware aside, I'm taking the malware as a separate part of this conversation, the Ace Magics, you can find yourself a stonking good deal on some incredibly powerful hardware. Rip out that SSD, load up Windows totally fresh. I think you've got yourself a pretty good bargain. The laptop is a different conversation. What the prices that you would pay for one of these laptops, you could probably find an inexpensive name brand laptop. Maybe it won't be quite as powerful, but it'll be an overall nicer experience. Maybe it has a nicer screen and a better chassis under the keyboard. Maybe it's a bit more spill resistant. You know, things like that, I think you can carry a little bit further. Or you can go even less expensive and go Chromebook or something like that. So it's a nuanced conversation. And that's what I'm trying to get into in that video. I had to kind of just talk out some of that here in for just a bit. Oh, yeah, Dave Burns with Thunderbolt 4. We may yet see a revival of eGPUs, too. It could be really cool. I know with Minis Forum, they just put out their Surface clone with an AMD chip. Excuse me, sorry. One of those shots, I think they were showing it using an external GPU. So again, your ability to like take a tablet out just to do your remote stuff and then dock it and create like a full-fledged desktop workstation-grade experience, I think will improve. Fingers crossed, I'm hoping we'll also see some of that advancement happen with ARM chips and X Elite, because I would love to have a really great, long-lived battery life kind of experience when I'm out and about, and then come home and just take this tablet and pop it in between two larger external monitors and have those monitors powered by an external desktop GPU. Would be awesome. I'm really hoping that that plays out. Yeah, Michael Corcoran saying, seeing all these headaches people are having with Ace Magician Minis Forum makes me wonder if I would just buy a Steam Deck instead. It has similar internals to some of them. You're always going to run into that performance conversation. Steam Deck is great. Even some of the others, the Lenovo, the Asus, the MSI that's coming out has the Intel chip in it. Really, 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 really solid gear. But we're about to see some of the more expensive mini PCs coming out with 13th gen Intel and with the, I think we're going to see the 8940, that new Ryzen chip. And yeah, that's probably going to be more expensive than a Steam Deck. But depending on what you're trying to do, like if you're gaming mostly at home and you spend a little bit more on that, it's going to outpace Steam Deck. So I'm really anxious to see over the next year. AMD's APUs are looking really solid. X Elite is looking really good performance per watt. I'm wondering if like the next version of like Steam Deck isn't going to go ARM. So I'll save that for another part of the conversation and stuff. Lax Pros. Wait, you make the fan faster by turning a knob? That's pretty cool. I missed having, we used to have these beige, ugly computer boxes, and in the front of the box would be a turbo button. You push it, and basically nothing would happen, but you felt, oh, I'm getting all the performance. I'm hitting the turbos on my PC. As I used to work on cars, and I loved bolting turbos onto, you know, silly little hatchbacks and stuff. That kind of experience is captured here. Only you do readily hear the difference. If you roll it back to silent operation, man, the performance craters. The auto doesn't do much, in my opinion. As soon as you start using it, it just ramps the fans up faster. So if I know I'm going to need it, I just go all the way to the performance, and the fan just turns on, basically full tilt, and that's pretty nice. I like having that, at least that, because I'm the kind of guy who way overcorrects for fan curves. Like on my GPU software, as soon as it's above 30 degrees C, it's like, nah, just go ahead and turn on the fans. So I'm rendering video and silent, silent, silent. So it's pretty great. Michael Corcoran, it'd be interesting if like your Samsung phone had a little slider on the left where you could change the performance. It would be nice if Samsung would just, in software, let us change the performance. They got rid of our, what do we call that? The high performance mode? I know on like some phones it's monster mode or something like that. But yeah, the chips that are in Samsung phones are capable of much more direct, brutal output than you're ever allowed to use. And proof positive, when you pick up a Xiaomi or a Vivo or a OnePlus or any of these other phones that have that higher performance curve, we just got another update on the Razer Edge gaming handheld. And I don't know if I just missed it before, if they added it, but now there is in the battery mode a high performance curve for the Razer Edge. And this has a fan. So it's a little mini cooled Snapdragon 888 that when you crank on the battery performance mode and the fan is going full tilt, it's like you get a generation ahead in terms of performance, and it still runs more consistently than like an 8 Gen 1. So, things like that really help. I wish they would do that. Dave Burns, eGPUs on ARM might become a driver availability issue. Absolutely true. That was the funny admission from a Qualcomm engineer when we were down in San Diego, and TK can confirm this. We're sitting in this like round table. Of course, we're asking all these questions that the engineer can't answer just because of like OEM NDAs and different vendor relationships and proprietary information. And someone just kind of point blanks him in the middle of this conversation. And I'm like, what about external GPUs? And you can tell he's kind of like in the flow of technical question, technical guidance. And he says literally, well, there's no technical reason why you couldn't use a GPU, an external GPU with X-Elite. And then he makes eye contact with the person and then he just stops talking. It was a great moment as we're all like, no technical reason. Go on. So, I believe NVIDIA, it would be in NVIDIA's interest to say, hey, if you would love to have actual gaming performance on Windows on ARM, you can always use one of our 40 series GPUs in this kind of enclosure. I don't think NVIDIA would want to hold back driver support, but these relationships get weird and funky, and because the GPU in the Adreno already has its own NPU attached to it, NVIDIA might be like, nah, I don't know. Let me get this out of the way. Awesome Possum. The MicroStar Dragon is too cute not to fanboy. It's okay to fanboy on my podcast, and it is. It's adorable. Dave Burns, compatibility layers with ARM might be what keeps Steam OS on x86. That is... So, in the first launch for X Elite, I think it's going to be really rough going for people who want to do things like throw Linux on a laptop. The support is going to be a bit more phone-like to start. You have a very distinct OEM vendor relation between Qualcomm and the companies making these laptops. So I don't think it's going to open up right away. I think it's going to take a while before those other companies start to feel pressure to get things like better corporate support. And once that starts to happen, I think this will all sort of open up a little. At the same time, I have to believe a MediaTek will want to get into the conversation. AMD will want to focus on other relationships. NVIDIA could come back with another Tegra. I don't know. I don't think these companies are going to want to let Qualcomm completely dominate Windows on ARM. But as soon as this starts to open up a little bit, we're going to have a ton of potential. And this is also kind of going hand in hand with the fact that Qualcomm's XR chips are very similar to their Snapdragon. They are Snapdragon chips, but I mean their Snapdragon phone, tablet, laptop chips, Chromebook chips, stuff like that. So if Valve is working with Qualcomm to put XR Gen 3 into a Valve Index, and Facebook is doing that with Oculus for whatever Oculus follow-up, Oculus Quest 4, whatever we get, then I think it'll be likely that Valve can turn to Qualcomm and say, hey, we want to put this in a Steam Deck too. What can we do to make sure that we've got, you know, Proton and all this other stuff working as well as it should? And then that just opens the floodgates. I think that is a massive turning point in mobility. It's why Nintendo made the right choice going with a little Tegra chip and getting their developers to just focus on maximizing the potential of the Tegra. It's better for portable gaming. It just is. So that was a long and rambling move through one story in housekeeping. We also just did a quick update on, we talked about this on the podcast, Google's Find My Device update is live on all phones that I know of now, and I shared some thoughts on what I thought the future of device and tracker availability was going to look like. So companies like Chipolo and Pebblebee, I was corrected. Apparently, Tile might not be joining this, and I'll be very curious to see if maybe they consider some kind of like class action suit, just to say it's anti-competitive for them to kind of piggyback on Tile's business model. And then this was just a really fun twofer to put together. My friend Ricky, the YouTube tech guy, R-I-C-K-Y, the YouTube tech guy, we staged a little debate, wireless charging versus fast charging. We actually started this at the end of last year with the S23 Ultra and the OnePlus 11, but it took us so long to kind of finish the idea up that we switched it over and did the S24 Ultra versus the OnePlus 12. And he was one of the few friends that I had that really came out and said, like, not only do I like wireless charging, I actually prefer it over fast charging, and I would be willing to, in a video, explain my thoughts. So there's a back and forth. I'm on his channel talking about fast charging, he's on my channel talking about wireless charging, and if you watch the two videos together, you kind of get a sense of where we're at in these different types of technologies. I still feel like true fast charging is the main decider for me. Like, if you put me on the spot and you said, hey, you could have this really amazing phone, but you have to choose between real, actual, true fast charging or wireless charging, I would drop wireless charging in a heartbeat. And that's kind of that's kind of the situation that OnePlus brought. I don't miss wireless charging when I'm using my OnePlus Open. It's fine. It's better than fine. I actually prefer it that way. And then lastly, this one was super fun. Like I said, Miriam had me on the Tank Girl podcast. Qualcomm Snapdragon X Elite and the future of ARM PCs, Xiaomi 14 versus Vivo V30 Pro, ZTE, Nubia Flip 5, and more with YouTube creator Juan Carlos Bagnell. And so we had a lovely, we actually ran a little long. Shockingly, a podcast with me on it took longer than an hour to get through everything, because we're both very long-winded individuals who like to go off on techie tangents. It says right here, it's an hour and 15. So I think she did cut it down a little bit. But yeah, we were talking a bunch of different phones and then some of the exciting developments that we've seen, like kind of redefining premium tier phones. The Xiaomi 14 is kind of embarrassing the Galaxy S24. And then the Vivo V30 Pro, very different. Obviously, this is more of like an upper mid-ranger kind of segment. But this Vivo is the first V series that the Zeiss logo, they felt confident enough in the camera experience that they put on that Zeiss logo on the back. So just kind of interesting to see where tech is trickling down into more affordable prices, because the cameras on the Xiaomi 14 can go head to head with phones like the S24 Ultra, but it's not the ultra tier phone. It's the regular premium tier phone. So that kind of experience, what Samsung is charging, has already fallen $300 in what you can get in a smaller pocketable computing device. Ditto, the kind of camera experience that we've got on the Vivo V30 is pacing and kind of outperforming the S24 in a lot of metrics. Not in the brute force, like, oh, you can't shoot 8K at 30 frames per second. Oh, what the heck? It is a mid-ranger phone. But those camera sensors, each in their own way, kind of outperform what Samsung is putting on a Galaxy S24. And the Vivo V series is meant to be more like a $400 to $600 phone, not a $700 to $800 phone. So it's been really fun watching these parts and pieces kind of move around, except for those of us in North America that don't get to benefit from this pricing competition. So we had a fun chat about that, and especially like both being Western producers and creators and reviewers, but who very much enjoy the international side of this conversation. So that was a really fun podcast. And if you don't get enough of me talking at you once a week, it's nice to have kind of another voice in the mix, which is pretty great. Ground Attack, let's face it, if you can't shoot 8K, it should be placed firmly on the trash heap. Ugh, garbage. Am I right? Garbage. We got wireless. Simon says, Hypno says, wireless charging has its place. That place being below wired charging. Correct, good sir. Correct. As Alsabakli. To be honest, I only ever charge wired when on a trip or if I need very rarely an emergency charge during the day. I'm kind of the opposite. For me, it's I try not to charge my phone ever until I need to. And that's a fundamental psychological difference between the two. So all of the housekeeping, all of the links and articles, guest podcast, everything is going to be available on this week's blog post. All of the links are going to be shared there on somegadgetguide.com. And let me get this out of the way here, because I think we should try and get a little news out now that we've gone 40 minutes on intro and housekeeping. The nice thing is that some of this is really just follow-up stuff that we can kind of chew through. And then if we get to the end of this and we manage to make it through all the links, if we want to do a little just sort of viewer Q&A or are there any other questions on things coming down the pipe, just let me know. So, yes, all the notes and links, somegadgetguide.com. Starting off with a story from my man crush, John Brodkin. This is my techie geeky man crush. Starting today, ISPs must display labels with price, speeds, and data caps. ISPs comply with FCC rule after protesting requirement to list all fees. Quote, today's nationwide launch of the broadband consumer labels means internet service providers are now required to display consumer-friendly labels at the point of sale. Labels are required for all standalone home or fixed internet service or mobile broadband plans. Providers must display the label, not simply an icon or link to the label, in close proximity to an associated plan's advertisement from the FCC. And they have this cute little, it looks like the nutrition label on a food product. And you go through and it just lists out, you know, the monthly price is this much, many dollars, additional charges and terms. And they have to break down what all of the individual fees are supposed to look like. And the speeds provided with the plan, you know, typical versus, they don't list it as total. So here in this example, it says typical download, typical upload, and typical latency. But they're not listing, you know, up to your peak total speed, right? Remember how ISPs used to kind of get around that where, well, yeah, I mean, your peak speeds could be like 600 megabits. But then you'd plug it in and he's like, I'm getting 40. But for a microsecond, it can spike to 600 megabits and then it completely falls apart. But that's what you're paying for. You're paying for the total. It could peak that hot. Whoa, that could be insane for half a second. Yeah, look at that. So I just kind of want to point out, so first of all, these should be going live. And if you sign up for a new service, if you sign up for new broadband or a new mobile service, you should be able to find, and according to the FCC, it should be easy to find a vertical graph that totally breaks down everything that's associated with your plan. And if you want to dig into the how long is this, what is the commitment, how many months am I on a contract, blah, 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 it should all be listed in one clear, easy to read vertical. One of the things that has monstrously pissed me off when trying to shop for broadband service generally is you go to a Spectrum or a Comcast or an AT&T and you go like, well, just what are your plans? And then you get this up to a gigabit. Okay, I know I'm not getting a gigabit on cable. I know you're lying already, okay? You can tell me it's up to that, but I know I'm not getting sustained traffic, especially at peak speeds on copper gigabit download. What's the upload? Oh, there's no way to know. You have to go digging through like incredible fine print to just find what is the upload speed, because our data is so hilariously asymmetrical now. This is killing me watching other parts of the world just completely leapfrog the United States in at least offering symmetrical uploads and downloads, and often above our cable broadband download speeds. So this to me is a ridiculous step that took way too long to finally arrive. And I love, ISPs comply with FCC rule after protesting requirement to list all fees. We talked about this, I think, a couple months back. Apparently, it's just been fine that ISPs could sign you up for a service that was going to charge you every month, and they had no obligation to tell you how much it was going to cost you. How are we operating in the year of our tech, 2024, that we're just now saying, no, you really do need to tell people how much it's going to cost? Like, what other industry works that way? I'm earnestly asking. I know, like, you go into a car dealership and you have to do stupid haggling to eventually arrive at a price. But then you get tons of paperwork that you have to sign and fill out, and it's listed, and it's really stupid and confusing legalese, but you eventually get to a page that says, this is how much money we say the car costs right now. Here are all of our stupid dealer markup fees. This is the financing that you've been approved for, and this works out at this interest rate to cost you this much money per month. I can't think of, like, the most infuriating consumer experience, in my opinion, is shopping for a car. We actually got one of our cars after, like, screaming with a manager about the financing rate and how much we were approved for. They said they had this model year. They didn't have it. They called us out there to drive a newer model year, tried to charge us extra. And we eventually, like, were walking out of the dealership when they finally threw papers in our face for what we wanted. Never buying a Nissan ever again. So, to think that that process of staying in a car dealership for hours, running credit checks, and eventually arriving at a number through insane shouting, belligerent haggling was still more clear than getting broadband service blows my mind. So, it's been long fought, but we're finally there. Now, when you sign up for broadband service, they have to tell you how much it's going to cost. We're doomed. We're doomed as a species. Like, that's ridiculous. It's so bad. Yeah, Grounded Tech, protesting that is pretty wild. It's a too large to care corporate apathy. Like, Apple, Comcast, and Spectrum know you can't go anywhere else to shop for competing service, and they've worked very hard to make it undesirable to ever compete with them in major markets. So they've had the ability to turn the screws on regulators and say, but what else are you gonna do? They don't have choices. And this is what we talk about when we say, you know, monopolistic or anti-consumer or anti-competitive business practices. It doesn't matter that there are technically other phones that you can buy other than the iPhone. That's not what makes for monopoly business practices. What matters is that you are now harming competition and disrupting a consumer's ability to shop around, and that you're getting in the way of a market, and that's chilling the market. So maybe at some point, we'll see state and city officials start getting after all of the ridiculousness that we've had to face with broadband in this country, which is just dumb. Yeah, see, Nicholas, I have 226 down, 192 up on fiber. Officially, it's 200-100 for 50 euro. So your upload speeds are 5 times faster than mine, and I pay a heck of a lot more than you do. Oh, Gabaletta, you're right. I'm sorry. I'm being a bit glib. Gabaletta says, but Juan, think about all of the poor little ISPs that now have to tell consumers the truth. I am actively looking into what it might be like to try a broadband co-op in my neighborhood. I don't think I'll have the momentum to pull it off, but I would really like to see at some point if I can get enough of our little condo association neighbors on board that we could just roll our own fiber line to the node that's literally across the street. I can see where fiber is from my house, but we don't get it here. And instead, we're stuck with Spectrum, or I mean, I guess you could also do like Verizon 5G home wireless, or DSL, and it's awful, and I hate it. So I'm going to start looking at just, what does that look like? Maybe if I talk to our city council and say, hey, this is something that we're interested in, how badly are you going to hurt us over this? I just want to know. Moving on. I think I might do just a quick little video, maybe even a short on this one. I am not loving some of the aesthetic and marketing changes coming to Windows. I prefer Windows over Mac, but lately I've also been spending a lot of time on Chrome and Linux. So I'm kind of spreading myself out a bit. But if you're on the Windows 11, this story written up by Sean Endicott over at Windows Central, Windows 11 doesn't have enough ads, says Microsoft's latest plan to force more ads onto your PC. You've seen ads in the top half of the Windows 11 start menu, but now the company is testing them in the bottom half of the menu too. So if you're on one of the beta tracks, which I am, one of the sort of early release software patches for Windows 11, where I'm trying to stay up to date on everything that's happening in Windows for better or worse, you're going to start seeing some of these changes, but really it's not too difficult. It's two layers deeper than it should be. When you go into your settings and then go into your appearance and then go into, there's a little toggle for like additional information and promotions and stuff that you can disable seeing these. But again, to me, that's sort of banking on a consumer not knowing that that setting exists, where it exists, how to find it, etc., etc. So I think things like this are pretty scummy. We recently saw, you know, like Apple's, the report came out. Oh, I should have added this to the show notes. I don't know that I can find a link really, really quickly, but it was recently just studied. There was a study that was published that said Apple's privacy and data tracking tools for the iPhone are basically nonsense. They're basically just theater. They're for show. So when you get your new iPhone and you set it up and you say, hey, don't track my info, don't do this, disable Siri, blah, 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 blah. What Apple has done is just put up these toggles for their own apps and services so that you feel like you've disabled it. But really, you've done nothing. So if you disable Siri, it's still tracking everything you do on the phone and sending that up to an Apple server. And you can't really fully escape it. People who have studied like how the iPhone transmits data, the iPhone will eventually say, oh, we're not getting these regular heartbeat updates on all of your behavior, so you must have been in like I don't know, poor data connectivity. So the next time you're on Wi-Fi, we'll just do a data dump for you then. So even when you're trying to like manage how much information of yours is getting sent up to Apple servers, Apple is obfuscating those settings, making it look like you've disabled this stuff, but really you've done nothing. It's security theater. It's privacy theater. It looks good in an advertisement. It's just as in-depth and as involved because they have a huge financial incentive to bump up their advertising network rates. It's the same as using like a whole bunch of Google services and not like really keeping tabs on what Google is tracking you. Only when we hear about Google doing this stuff, we actually do see some kind of regulatory pushback, which then results in yet another confusing toggle for consumers, but it's the appearance of some kind of change for that setting. So again, all three, our Googles, our Apples, and our Microsofts are now trying to find other ways of generating revenue based on your user behavior and your data, and then using that to put ads in places that make us not want to use their products or services. And then they see this pushback with like ad blockers and with like flashed ROMs, or our buddy Andrew Fat Produce in the chat is using a totally different start menu. And then they're like, oh, but wait a minute, if more people are doing these things, then maybe we need to put more ads for the people who don't know how to use ad blockers. It has this huge Streisand effect. At some point, you do want to say, hey, maybe just sell Windows again, instead of making it this almost free service. Like, you can go and buy a license of Windows now, but I'm looking at 5, 6. I have 8 PCs in my office right now, and I haven't paid for a single license of Windows 11 on any of them. And maybe it's just okay if I go back to paying for licenses of Windows again, because I'm very aggressive in turning all of that stuff off. Windows is essentially now just freemium software for me, and it's silly. It's silly that we're trying to work it that way. Michael Corcoran, that's hilarious. If I was president, I would nationalize Windows, give it away as a human right with no ads, or I would at least urge my cabinet and Congress to regulate them more. It's probably more likely Microsoft is easier to regulate than any other company. I don't know, there's just such an entrenched memory of Microsoft as a juggernaut. And now, because we have another story coming up about AI, it's just funny that, like, Apple and Google can get away with so much more than Microsoft can. I'm not trying to correct for this. I think this is a stupid move on Microsoft's part. But I also think, man, if you tried to nationalize Windows, I'd be willing to bet that Microsoft would claim it's something like 30% of how they entrench services and build products and monetize users. And so what, they're a $3 trillion company? I think nationalizing Windows would be about $1 trillion. I'm not sure we have the fortitude as a government to pay that off or to make that work. It's pretty rough.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Oh, yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech where you... See, I already f***ed it up. that's okay, because I don't want to stop the recording, because then we got to redo it all. So I'll just put it apart. Do you like podcasts?
Yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech?
Hell yeah.
Do you like podcasts about tech that have your favorite creators like Juan Carlos Bagnell, TK Bay, and many, many more?
Oh, yeah.
Well, if you do, you should check out the Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe. It's a podcast about everything tech and sport and food and getting to know your favorite creators from the back end. Like, you know, you could watch their podcast and hear what they have to say about tech, but where do they go to high school? What did they like to do before they became a podcaster or a tech creator or a YouTuber or a Twitch streamer? Check us out. We're on every Sunday from 3 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. BST in the UK.
Ish.
We'd love to have you. Maybe throw a sub and tell your friends about it. Again, Nomad Tech Project with Sam and Joe on your favorite podcast aggregators. Take care. Love your faces. Be excellent to each other. We'll see you on the show.
Goodbye.
All right, quick drink of water there. We got a couple of AI stories, which is why I wanted to bring some of this up. I am not as well read on this. I kind of read through this Bloomberg article, and I don't feel it was super enlightening as to what the exact nature of the relationships were, but it did just kind of help call into question when companies are doing things like saying, like, oh, well, we're going to do this AI platform, but we're going to do ours different, or we're going to make it safer, or it's going to be more ethical. Adobe got a lot of positive press for saying, hey, our AI tools are ethical. Well, written up by Rachel Metz and Brody Ford over on Bloomberg, Adobe's ethical Firefly AI was trained on Midjourney images. Company promotes its tool as safe from content scraped from the internet, but it was trained on content scraped from the internet. When Adobe Inc. released its Firefly image generating software last year, the company said the artificial intelligence model was trained mainly on Adobe stock, its database of hundreds of millions of licensed images. Firefly, Adobe said, was, quote, a commercially safe alternative to competitors like Midjourney, which learned by scraping pictures from across the internet. But behind the scenes, Adobe was relying in part on AI-generated content to train Firefly, including from those same AI rivals. In numerous presentations and public posts about how Firefly is safer than the competition due to its training data, Adobe never made clear that its model actually used images from some of these same competitors. So there's really just kind of no escaping how brutally, again, I keep wanting to come back to words like apathy. You can have a Sam Altman go out there and talk about all of these aspirational things about AI, but it kind of sounds like every other generational automation job-killing tool we've seen in the past. Oh, no, what this is going to do is it's going to free up people. They're going to have to, they'll work less, but there'll be more productivity and everyone's going to make more money and everything's going to be great. But really what happens is then you just take the humans and you keep squeezing fewer and fewer employees for higher and higher productivity while these tools don't really do what they claim to do. These tools don't really facilitate that. You know, I miss, like, I don't know if you're watching the Fallout show. There's this, like, really lovely, anachronistic, faux retro-futuristic vibe to the Fallout universe. And in that universe, there is that feeling of prosperity for some of the rich because of these, like, wonderful advances in technology. And I go back to, you know, the Isaac Asimov's robot stories. You know, you're going to have a robot butler and you can take care of all this stuff for you and free up all of this housework and all this stuff. And you realize, like, that is so optimistic, that fantasy is so unrealistic. Because instead, what we have is a market where every time a new tool comes out, rich people try to find ways of making poor people even poorer. That's essentially what happens. How can we get rid of all these jobs, make more money for our shareholders, and then all these people end up being desperate, so they'll work for even less money, but they'll work more because we'll demand it of them. And every time I see a Sam Altman interview, all I can think is, well, this guy is either delusional or he's a liar. Like, at some point, you start listening to this hype around yet another, what I feel is kind of a rug pull, looking at the AI market as it exists today. And you're like, but none of that's going to happen. The way that they're presenting this, none of that's going to be real. So, even when a company has access to an incredible database of images, of content, of video clips, they can pay for that information. Even then, it's just too easy for an AI tool to go scraping content from a competing tool. And in this case, Midjourney is one of those that has been most scrutinized for just eating up the internet without any permissions from the people that actually made this content. So at some point, you have to say, Adobe went out there to advertise that Firefly was going to be more ethical. They made a claim. And this is where the FTC can now get involved and say, hey, you have misrepresented your product. And people have made purchasing decisions and have used your product based on this false presentation of what you claimed was ethical AI. And now we have a case that we can examine in a court of law. It's the same thing. Like, Samsung, years and years and years ago, Samsung made this big claim in one of their presentations that they were not using labor under inhumane conditions. Then it was revealed that, no, Samsung manufacturing actually depended quite a bit on these facilities, which were not run in a very humane fashion. We didn't go after Samsung because of the business practice. We went after Samsung because they marketed that they were using more ethical construction. The marketing matters more than the actual human misery or human cost. So it doesn't matter that Adobe has now scraped copyrighted material and web-based material, which they didn't pay for. No one cares about that because that's only going to affect little and poor people. What matters is that Adobe advertised that they were an ethical AI. And now we can actually... So if you are like me and you like to regularly send messages to the FTC and your local state attorneys general, this would be another one that you can just copy this link. You can go to my show notes, hit the Bloomberg link, say, hey, they made this big presentation that they were not scraping content off the web. And then they used content that was scraped from off the web. That to me is misrepresentation, and I feel it deserves some kind of scrutiny from regulators. Either that, or you just go and complain on social media and nothing happens. I mean, in fact, if you were thinking like, hey, I think this should be a tweet and people need to know that it's unethical, that doesn't matter. It will do literally nothing. Except enrich the social media platform if you gin up some kind of engagement or debate or argument, but literally nothing will happen. There is a public-facing resource with the FTC where you can go and say, hey, this looks akin to some kind of anti-consumer or anti-competitive business practice. And here's a story from Bloomberg, and here's the claim that they made, and it obviously turned out to not be true, and AI is burning billions of dollars right now. This is a massive industry. So I think it matters when one of the absolute biggest content producing platforms of the world is engaged in the shenanigans. Dave Burns, Juan Bagnell, liberal communist soy boy. But it's all about making money, Dave. That's just it, man. Who's making the money? We want to see people make money, right? Aditi Anil, Lina Khan strikes fear in the hearts of big tech yet again. It was, again, hilarious, like watching Jon Stewart talk to the chairwoman of the FTC and saying, literally to her face, we wanted to have you on a podcast, and Apple said, no, don't talk to her. And that Apple has this kind of control over our media should make us all very concerned. Oh, vulgarity, yeah. As always, with great power comes no responsibility. No, there's a responsibility. There's a responsibility to your shareholders and to paying off politicians. I mean, campaign contributions to influence politicians. So this one sparked a little bit of a conversation on the Discord, written up by Michael Kahn over at PC Mag. There's my screen share. Google throws in the towel on its VPN. The company tells Google One users that the VPN perk will be discontinued later this year. And I love the first line from this article. The Google graveyard has claimed another victim. I just said Google graveyard and four phones on my desk just lit up. Let me get this back out of screen share. Now, on the one hand, I totally appreciate Google's reasoning, because they said, oh, well, no one was really using it. But you made this a part of their subscription. So our friend Paul on the Discord, brings up what exactly is the most germane point. It kind of doesn't matter if not enough people were really using it. The Google One subscription was sold to people as this being one of those perks that was included in the subscription. It'd be kind of like, I pay for Microsoft 365. Both my wife and I need to have Microsoft accounts just for different jobs and work, and we kind of like using OneDrive over any of the other cloud services just for our like little family photo galleries and stuff. But it would be like, oh, well, not a lot of people are using the Skype part of Microsoft 365, so we're just going to get rid of that for you. You're like, no, we're paying for this subscription with these services built into it. That's what you sold us on. And so it doesn't look like there's going to be any major changes. I seriously doubt Google's going to charge you less for Google One just because not enough people were using the VPN. So that is actually frustrating. That is kind of scummy. And especially it being such a high-profile subscription service from Google, that's the ability to help promote more consumer education on why you should use something like a VPN in certain situations, or why this is a useful add-on to your service. So that one was kind of frustrating to read through, because in the proper context of in poopification We're seeing costs go higher and higher and higher, and we're getting less and less and less for our money whenever we're kind of tacking on these extra subscription services. So the flip side of this is, for a lot of people, when they kind of, when the news broke that Google was ending their VPN support, it was sort of buried under the bigger headline. The big blog post that went out kind of roughly the same time was that, let me get this out of the way here. Okay. From the official Google The Keyword blog, AI editing tools are coming to all Google Photos users. Magic Editor, Photo Umbler, Magic Eraser, and more enhanced editing features are coming to all Google Photos users. No subscription required. Huge asterisk. They did not put the huge asterisk under the headline of that article. So yes, we are getting all of these Magic Editor online AI tools. So if you use Google Photos and you're, I guess, uploading to your paltry collection, your, was it 15 gigs, something like that? Which I'm regularly being warned by Gmail that I'm almost out of space and I have to go and delete more and more stuff from my email and what few photos I actually do back up on Google Cloud. Now everyone is going to have access. So not only all Android phones, but then also all iPhones. That if you use Google Photos, you can unblur and you can cut things out of photos and move them around or make the sky look bluer. All the kinds of things that I'm not, I don't know, I'm just not the biggest fan of. Like the Magic Eraser tool, I think, is the only thing I've been using somewhat frequently in this current batch of AI-enabled tools. And it's just kind of funny because, well, I say, like, I have been using Magic Eraser. The most recent OnePlus update now has a very fast sort of blemish touch-up tool. It's not as good as Magic Eraser, but it's crazy fast. And when I'm doing things like I've got a really wide landscape and there are a couple people and I just want to wipe them out real quick, the OnePlus version of this is really good. The Samsung version of this is really good. We've been using now these Magic Eraser tools pretty for a lot. I have not run into a situation where I've wanted to cut something out of a photo and move it to some other location in the photo and then hope that some kind of AI tool can properly fill in the background. So the last time I needed to do sort of a cut and move, I did it on my desktop because I needed something really specific. And it was for a thumbnail. I was really just trying to compress something for a thumbnail. And that worked great, but that's not something I'm going to do from my phone. It's not the way that I kind of work or do sort of the mobile version of all of this on my phone. So it's kind of funny because, like, they're trying to still keep, Google is trying to still keep some kind of division between Pixel owners and subscribers, Google services subscribers, and then people that are just kind of on the free version of their apps and services. So no subscription required. If you're not paying for any additional storage or G Cloud or anything like that, No G1, no G Cloud, no storage, nothing. You have access to all of these tools now, up to 10 edits a month. They're server-side, so this costs Google money to run data centers and servers to do all of this processing. Totally understand it. But you can try it out now. You can try it out 10 times a month. And if you decide that, oh, this is something I'm really using a lot, then you can pay for a higher tier subscription. I don't know, will be available to anyone. So starting on May 15th, many of our AI-powered tools like Magic Eraser, Photo Unblur, and Portrait will be available to anyone using Google Photos, no subscription required. Your device must be Chromebook Plus. That's hilarious. So I clicked on the little annotation. Anyone using Google Photos. And all it says is your device must be a Chromebook Plus with Chrome OS version 118 Plus or have at least 3 gigabytes of RAM and Android 8, iOS 15 or higher. Oh, I see what they're saying. Okay, so they're not putting an annotation on no subscription required. They're putting the annotation on anyone using Google Photos. Okay, now my brain has clicked. Additionally, all Google Photo users on Android and iOS will get 10 Magic Editor saves per month. To go beyond this limit, you'll need a Pixel device or a premium Google One plan, 2 terabytes and above. So, a premium Google One plan is $9.99 a month. So, they want you spending $10 a month. Is that what I'm reading? You need to at least be doing $10 a month for Google One to then have... So you can't do this with the basic 100 gigabyte plan, which is $2 a month. You have to step up to the $10 a month plan. You're spending $100 a year. Is that, that's what it is, right? It's either $10 a month or $100 a year. Yeah. And then there's also the AI premium Gemini Advanced plan, which is even more expensive than $10 a month. I see, this is what's getting frustrated about AI, is companies like Google, they have this vested interest in setting up all these cloud servers and data centers, and they want everything to be done off the device. So we're starting to fall behind on some of the on-device AI stuff that I thought was really cool. Because it's better for them if you start using more things on your phone and then you have to buy your phone and pay subscriptions on what you're using on your phone. You're constantly generating revenue for the company. It's the hilariousness. We watched last night's Dodgers game because my daughter is now super, super into baseball on top of playing softball. And so many iPhone commercials for... Hey, don't throw out all of your photos. Don't worry. It's an iPhone, which is hilarious because Apple has like the worst pricing for storage on any mobile device. It's ludicrous. But so many of these commercials are this guy's looking at his phone and, oh, I don't want to delete all of these wacky photos and some of these photos that were obviously misfires. And I don't, oh, but I shouldn't have to manage all the, but don't worry. It's an iPhone. That's literally like the tag on the commercial. Not you can pay more to buy more storage or you can buy more iCloud. It's so dumbed down. The end of the commercial is literally just, don't worry, it's an iPhone. Which means nothing. It doesn't solve the problem that is presented in the commercial unless you somehow were ahead of buying more storage when you bought the phone in the first place, or you're just going to spend more and more and more and more every month on cloud storage, which again is such a ripoff. It's so predatory. And again, these companies are too big to care. There is nothing but apathy for what the actual consumer experience should resemble, because we'd normally just tell you, buy a memory card so you can dump all this stuff to a memory card. You can store more media. You can buy these like little, I've got a terabyte right here. Look at this. It's the size of my thumb. Bam, right there, Kingston. Look at that. It's thinner than my thumb and about the same size as my stumpy thumb. Terabyte, right there. That's all you need. Brilliant. So, because like 2 TB for a year is going to be $100. I did not spend $100 on that terabyte stick. It's pretty rough. So anyway, don't worry. You can pay $100 a year for your 2 terabytes of cloud storage that's doled out in small chunks and is much more difficult to use than it should be. And every time you share something from your cloud storage to someone else, you then have to go through this ridiculous dance of giving them permission to get the file that you sent them, because they maybe have a different Gmail account logged in and that wasn't what you sent it to. So then you've got to then send it back, and then they say, hey, can you approve me on this? And then you can approve them, and it never works. It's awful. I gave up on Google's cloud because it's terrible. If I send you a file on OneDrive, you click on a link and you download the file. That's it. That's all it should ever be. And I can then set a different thing, like this link will expire, or you can edit it if it's a document. And I don't see why anyone would use anything else. I really don't. Now, when it's really mission critical, even though I have a very slow upload speed, I'll send you a link from my NAS so that you can download it directly from the box of hard drives that I keep here in my office. And we have complete control over the share and exchange of that information. And I spent a lot of money on that NAS. It'll take years before I've technically matched the payout of paying for different cloud subscriptions. But there is no cloud subscription for 60 terabytes of hard drive space. Yeah, RAID is pretty cool. So anyway, I did want to kind of dovetail this. AI editing tools, Google Photos, I really feel like Xiaomi, Huawei, Vivo, Oppo, they are going to be pushing on device a lot harder. And what we see recently, the OnePlus Magic deletion tool is very good. Microsoft's, if you have a Windows PC that can tap MPU features in Windows photo app, Windows generative erase is really good. Like it's easily going toe-to-toe with on-device Magic Editor on Google devices, and it can sometimes kind of outperform some of the AI generative fill that we see in Magic Eraser Online, the more robust version, the cloud-based version, but it's running locally, and I'm running it on a little Windows on ARM tablet. Really, really good. All of these tools are kind of moving back and forth. So I wanted to do this as a pair. So we do have the story from Dave. Dave sent us a story about Microsoft building a new AI data center because you need more of that cloud AI money. But first, I wanted to just bring this up, because I think this is hilarious and tragic, but a step in a direction that is going to be very concerning for narrative content creators. And I mean that in television, in feature films, in web content, not just content creator, I shoot videos on the internet. So TCL is doing something kind of disruptive. Sorry, this story is coming by way of Chris Holt over at Engadget. TCL's first original movie is an absurd-looking AI-generated love story. So I need everyone to try and catch this trailer, because this trailer is hilarious, but also a terrible warning sign of things to come. So the movie is going to be called Next Stop Paris, and it is AI generated, and you can see in the trailer. Hold on, I'm going to try and mute this. I bet you this might get kind of weird, because I'm trying not to do like anything that's going to be major copyrighty strikey or anything like that. But we might get tagged. We'll see. So in playing some of this, you can see just the AI-ness of these sort of uncanny valley faces and lip flap and dialogue that doesn't quite match, but it's pretty close, and lots of these close-ups. A lot of the golden tone AI quality, that plasticky animated look. So I'm bringing this up because what they've created, what TCL has here in Next Stop Paris, obviously, this is going to be a real low-effort story, similar to like just those clones of clones of clones of Hallmark Channel movie originals, right? We don't go to a Hallmark romance or a Hallmark rom-com expecting any kind of cinematic brilliance. That's a factory that is just churning out content at an insane, at an incredible pace. So we look at Next Stop Paris, and we're all going to chuckle. It's totally plasticky. It looks totally fake. In the trailer, there's a sequence where an older, wiser character is talking to the young lady about finding the right time. If you land love at the right time, sage advice, and I'm holding grapes in a vineyard. And the animation that they show would make one suggest that they don't know how clocks work. Like, the clock ticks over, and I'm pretty sure the clock is saying it's either 6 o'clock or 12:30. I can't tell. But it clicks over in 5-minute increments. Which, again, is like, even the clock is an uncanny valley representation of how clocks work. And it is a little unsettling how close it looks to being kind of real, and then how plasticky and unsettling the final representation is. Like, we're in the deep gulf, in my opinion, we're in that deep gulf of Uncanny Valley. It gives me the willies. The incredible amount of compute power that was needed to generate these artificial characters, to keep them consistent so you could move them to different locations, to build parts of this so that you could set what would be a storyboard and then animate parts of the storyboard. Like, there's a sequence where a train goes through. Train looks pretty good. Sequence where a boat is going through like a canal in like a lovely Parisian city. That looks great. That kind of stuff, AI is doing really well. Someone sitting on a train with a moving background and they have to turn their head and talk, looks like you did a photo and then took a warp tool to pull their face in a different direction, but the outline of the profile of their face kind of stays in place. Really eerie. This could unintentionally be one of the most effective horror films of the year. But I'm not going to the end of this where then we say, oh, but obviously the AI would continue getting better. I'm going to take that as read. I think everyone in this chat is going to understand, yes, the AI tools will get better and more realistic. But I just think it's incredible that TCL and whoever they're working with in making this AI produced piece spent so much time and effort and literal electricity, so much energy on creating this. And what they've essentially accomplished is, what do you call those games? I've completely spaced the name of that game genre, but it's like a video comic book. Someone in the chat, please help my aged Swiss cheese brain. But it's not like a video game that you play. It's like you're just watching a story and then you've got like dialogue options that you can kind of tap into. That's essentially what they've created here. It's like, I remember it used to be a visual novel. Thank you. Vulgarity. Got it. Colonel Corn Pop. You've basically made a visual novel. That's what it is. Or a virtual novel from JGJ. Think of how much power is required on these data centers, how much electricity has been consumed, and you could have done a lot of this and probably with better results if we had just normalized storyboard style animation and visual novel style storytelling for grown-ups here in North America. I think it's funny in a roundabout way, there are so many dating sims that are of this sort of visual novel storytelling style. This could create sort of an open, if people watch this TCL movie, if people watch Next Stop Paris, and I'm assuming that the target demographic for this movie is going to be more on the sort of older female persuasion. That's my guess. I'm really not trying to diminish or, you know, sort of make this more of a conversation than it is. But I wonder if you point out to people that the sort of rubbery effect of watching AI-generated actors talk through their dialogue, if you didn't find that unsettling, this is kind of the perfect gateway drug to get those people interested in dating sims and visual novels and this kind of fantasy storytelling, which is done so much better with slightly more traditional animation techniques, and giving the player or the reader or the viewer some agency in the direction of the story. In a crazy and hilarious way, TCL might have created the perfect advertisement to get more people interested into a genre of gaming. I just wish that AI didn't require Herculean amounts of electricity and ridiculous amounts of water and humongous data centers and all of these enormous models and all of these crazy capabilities to produce, when I think you could have arrived at something that looked better if you had just taken real actors, no-name actors, just you can find pretty people by the boatload here in LA, and you just take a bunch of photographs of them on green screens. And then you kind of cut them out into other representations of city scenes. And then we can apply some of these animation techniques, and it would have looked better, and it would have been more in keeping with a dating sim or a visual novel. That to me is like, there's a better way to do this, that it would have looked better that they did it that way instead. And we could be normalizing animation as a grown-up storytelling technique. I'm actually kind of surprised. I just rewatched, like, I hadn't seen it in decades. And now I've, because my brain is focused. Is it Perfect Blue? It's an anime sort of drama. Oh, what is the name of this movie? Not Blue Velvet. Oh, come on. It's on my Plex. And let me just pull up my Plex. Sorry, folks. I think it's called Perfect Blue. No, not Neon Genesis Evangelion. Thank you, Dave. That's not helping. I'm trying to do search, and it's... Plex is letting me down. Yes, Perfect Blue. I'm gonna say vulgarity. Oh man, we're pulling out Perfect Blue. Okay, Perfect Blue is kind of an interesting drama thriller. I can't say it's aged super well. I can't say it's as effective as maybe when it first came out, but it tells a very interesting and unique story that in the United States, we only would have conceived of this story as being a live action thriller, probably starring a 1980s Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, something sort of scream queenie. And in Japan, it is just not an issue that we told this sort of psycho serial killer commentary on fame and warping your reality in animation. And when you watch Perfect Blue, it to me, it works better that it is in animation because there are these overly melodramatic elements to the story that play out in a more interesting way in a hyper-realized fictional fantasy world that's still grounded, but it's animated. And I just think it's a shame that really, I feel like romance is kind of a perfect genre to bring to animation. Think of all of the Disney princesses that have had romantic subplots in their adventure films. We've already primed an audience to expect there's a princess and maybe there's a prince that she's totally into, but there's an adventure and she learns and she grows along the way. And at the end, maybe there's a happily ever after kind of moment. Why didn't we continue growing these stories with the audience also aging? And TCL has this AI piece, which is really rubbery animation. It doesn't fool the eye. It doesn't convince me that these are real actors or real people doing a real romance schlocky film in Paris. Like that's not happening. So if this succeeds in any kind of mind share, if this gets any kind of traction and viewership, I just wonder. I wonder, is that the solution to maybe convincing a studio, like, hey, if you don't want to fly actors out on location to tell a story about a woman falling in love in Greece, maybe just animate it. Maybe that's better. So, yeah, I'm gonna take a drink of water here.
The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at MeAudio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
Yeah, Colonel Corn Pop. AI has been used to change the facial movements of characters in games to better match foreign languages. That's a good use of AI. Localization is, I think, a very good use of crafting a more organic experience based on another performance and presentation. Those slight alterations matter a lot. I just think it's kind of crazy to me. We're trying to rush this. AI can make an entire video. You remember all those Wes Anderson knockoffs? Like, it was a meme of a video style for a hot minute. Like, what if X-Men were made by Wes Anderson? And it's very rudimentary, simple, like, AI clones. Or what was the other, it was like a fashion designer. What if, what is the name of that crazy fashion label? Balenciaga? That's not what it is. Anyway, they did one. What if that fashion designer did Star Trek The Next Generation? It's all these like model looking types in this kind of like shabby chic kind of aesthetic. But you can totally see like, oh, well, that's the Geordi LaForge and that's the Worf. Klingons look very, very aesthetic now. It's like we're trying to push into that. Right now, AI is giving us the meme-y version of that. It's funny. It's wacky. It's good for a joke. The TCL movie here, I think, is going to be funny, wacky, good for a joke, but it could normalize an entirely different presentation for content and media. So I hope, I don't know. It would be interesting to see if out of a Next Stop Paris, someone says, oh, I actually kind of like Romance's animation. Like, that could be kind of interesting. That maybe I need to see what a grown-up movie from another country looks like. That could be cool. So the last AI bit of this, so we were talking about TCL and movies. We were also talking about cloud editing tools from Google. I was very impressed with Microsoft giving us on-device Magic Eraser-style capabilities in Windows. Out of the gate, this was published, I think, you know, like on Sunday. This was written up by Tech Radar, Wayne Williams over at Tech Radar. An incredible $100, let's try that headline again. An incredible $100 billion bet to get rid of NVIDIA dependence, tech experts reckon Microsoft will build a million server strong data center that will primarily use critical in-house components. From the article, Microsoft and OpenAI are reportedly in the process of planning a groundbreaking data center project, which would include an AI supercomputer named Stargate. That is a lot of money. The new data center project is expected to push the boundaries of AI capability, could potentially exceed $115 billion in expenses. This is more than triple the amount Microsoft spent on capital expenditures for servers and equipment last year. So Microsoft is currently working on a smaller fourth phase supercomputer for OpenAI that is expected to launch around 2026. So for us to keep growing, the capability of these style learning language models and Gen AI and Edge AI and whatever we're calling, dump a prompt into a massive brain computer and have it spit out language or spit out an image. To hit the next step, in quality is an order of magnitude more expensive. And in building a $100 billion facility of data centers and of in-house, and they also mentioned that a solution like this, if Microsoft builds their own kind of servers and data centers and supercomputers, it'll likely be ARM servers. So, okay, next platform also says if Stargate does come to fruition, it will be based on, quote, future generations of Cobalt ARM server processors and Maya XPUs with Ethernet scaling to hundreds of thousands to even a million XPUs in a single machine. So that is an incredible amount of money. That is an incredible amount of research, an incredible amount of R&D, and the electricity costs are going to be insane. The cooling costs are going to be insane. How do you make an AI startup in 2025? Someone who is really talented at this kind of coding or is looking to engineer these kinds of future solutions, do you go to a small shop and try and work with limited resources? And or do you just say, well, it's Microsoft, Facebook, or Google, or Amazon. They're paying $100 billion to make this incredible facility. I guess that's where I need to go. And at the end of all of this, we're still in dealing with issues of like, well, how do you train the models? How do you facilitate growth in the sector? How do you keep ripping off humans and looking at the content that they publish and the videos that they produce and the articles that they write and the music that they make, and then displacing the people that are actually making that content that the models are trained on, and the models aren't quite there yet to producing the same finished quality that audiences are looking for. But we look at the rubbery plastic, they look like Midjourney models in that TCL movie. If we want to make the next generation of that TCL, if we want to make the next generation of Next Stop Paris and make it look more realistic, we are spending an order of magnitude more to build that next version of a data center that can train even larger models, make even more detailed images, more fluidly animate those characters. It's incredible what that leap really looks like. Microsoft is one of the biggest cloud data-connected gaming companies on the planet. Think about how much money you would need to spend as a Microsoft to run the servers and the data centers and all of the cloud storage and all of the web tools, the functional backbone pieces of the internet that Microsoft is responsible for. And to spruce up OpenAI in 2027 to make the data center that would take us to the next version of OpenAI, Microsoft is going to have to triple what their spending on infrastructure was in 2023. That's just for this one project. This one AI solution is three times what they spent on servers and data and expenditures in 2023. Blows my mind that this is how much energy and effort it takes to take us up that next step. I mean, think about like when we make a game a little bit more photorealistic and then you have to spend a lot more on a GPU, right? Think about really, really good ray and path tracing, lighting effects in a video game, and how a really aggressive path tracing version of a game can still bring an RTX 4090 to its knees. And again, if it's not properly optimized or if it's just a really beefy presentation for that game, your $2,000 GPU is going to struggle. We're seeing sort of the real world AI ramifications of that play out. And it's not, oh, well, we'll throw in a few more server racks. No, it's we need to fundamentally change the ecology of an area by building a massive data center that is probably going to consume trillions of gallons of water and consume inordinate amounts of electricity. We are changing the surface of the earth to install a building large enough with millions of these little processing units inside of it so that you can make a nicer photo when you put in a prompt. I just don't... to me, the economy of scale, AI is not a feasible business model. It's not something that you build an economy on. It's not the next phase. It's not the smartphone. It's not the headphone. It's not the desktop computer. It is an incredible race of spending ridiculous amounts of money on a novelty right now that still doesn't answer fundamental questions on how we interface with technology and get results out of our computers, but we're sort of forced to embrace this next era because of shareholder concerns on AI being a part of a presentation, so a stock price goes up. It's incredible. I'm at a constant loss for how insane I think this market really is. I got to drink some water. Hold on one sec. Dave, yeah, pretty good, man. Dave says, how much electricity to pay people to not be creative? I think we're doing this automation thing backwards. Oh, I just clicked off my mic. Of course, I, for one, welcome our new AI overlords as I toil in the lithium mines to provide them with more electricity so they can make the beautiful art while I engage in back-breaking labor. That's what we want the machines to do, right? Is to make all of our art for us while we have to do harder work instead. It's going to be great. Yeah, and then he also says, and all it took was stealing all the water from a small municipal system. JGJ, are we becoming idiocracy? I think we're crossing that bridge, buddy. There's always room for us to turn around. But I don't see us decelerating to pull a U-turn. I see us accelerating to get to the end of that bridge. Nick Gay, I don't see how. Nick Say says, well, wouldn't the point of this be to lower the cost of daily cooling and computing data center? Also, Microsoft hasn't proven that AI is profitable for them yet. But that's what I mean, is like, there is no AI model that is generating profit. We're all still in that phase of AI being the cool new thing that you're trying out in Copilot or on your Android phone, or you're wishing Apple would add to Siri. It's all in the novelty phase. And they're all the major corporations here are trying to create models and business practices that lock you into increasing dependence and regular monetization subscriptions. So you have to keep using this product to stay competitive, but then you have to keep paying to be able to have access to the product. And there really isn't. We haven't seen demonstrated. How does this make money? If you're telling me you're about to dump over $100 billion into one project of a data center, and you're also creating your own custom server solutions to power that data center, the R&D is probably on top of the actual $100 billion that is going to be necessary to facilitate this manufacturing. When do you make $100 billion in profits to offset the costs? Because I don't think that's happening yet. I feel like Facebook and Microsoft and Apple and Google are taking money from other profitable ventures. And like Google and Apple, they're trying to, and Microsoft, we just had a story about Microsoft trying to put more ads into your start bar. Well, the money from those ads in your iPhone and in your Google phone and in your Microsoft computer, that money is going towards the investment of an AI tool set that I still don't understand how that generates profit on its own. Because the next time they're going to spend $100 billion on this server, then Facebook is going to say, oh, well, we don't want to lose talent and we don't want to lose capabilities. And we want to make sure we're at the cutting edge of AI. So we'll also build massive data centers and we're going to outpower Microsoft. There's $150 billion of infrastructure right there. And then Microsoft's going to go, oh, no, OpenAI only has this $100 billion facility. I guess we also need to spend more money on these other data centers. And then there's going to be another $50 billion that goes in that direction. At some point, we all need to kind of say the ever-increasing march of AI feature improvement and capabilities is not demonstrating the potential to increase revenues and increase profits for it to be its own market. I don't see how you cross that tipping point into profitability when, so far, every major generational improvement has been an order of magnitude more expensive to reach. I am being cynical. I am not impressed with the current conversation or capabilities of AI, and I don't believe it's achieving what this kind of neural computing is really good at. For scientific research, for data modeling, for clustering information, for getting results out of, you know, huge pockets of data, this type of neural computing is really cool. Think about all, like, I was a person who used to leave my PC running to do folding at home, and it would tap my GPU and I would send data up to researchers and they'd crunch information on my home rig while I slept. Like, that kind of stuff is awesome. What we're trying to build, what trying to sell AI today is not that. I if you told me that the government wanted to invest $100 billion into edge AI computing resources so that we could improve space travel, heck yeah, I'm all for it. Well, tell me where to sign. I will pay you more in taxes because I would love to see humans leave this planet, at least in a reasonable way, not in the way that Elon Musk says that we will. Joe Hickey from the Nomad Tech Project. Sam and Joe. But AI is everything. And right now, it's all because shareholders are clinging to this, like, rug pull after rug pull after rug pull. A couple years ago, it was, are you putting NFTs in things? If I don't hear NFT, then I'm not excited, and you aren't demonstrating a business model that will earn me more profit on the investment that I made in your company, and now the stock price has gone down. And that was a total catastrophe. I'm so tired of these, like, fad investor strategies. Because, like, again, you just slapped the label AI on language learning models. It's not intelligence in any conceivable way, but now we're all stuck with this version of an economy that's built on displacing human creativity. It's just really dumb. Oh, Michael Corcoran, that sounds too depressing for me. Michael says, it's interesting to go to shareholder meeting transcripts and control F for the term AI, and then compare it to the same process 2 or 3 years ago when crypto, blockchain, and NFT were the future. And I still recommend this. There's that documentary, Printing the Future. I don't know if it's still on Netflix. I think it was a Netflix joint. But it's like, take every major claim from a Sam Altman today about how AI is going to do this, and it's going to change the way we do that, and it's going to disrupt, and it's going to make people more productive, and it's going to make companies more money. And then go and watch this low-budget documentary talking about 3D printers and how they were going to revolutionize manufacturing, and they were going to change how we interacted with companies. And you're never going to be in that position where you've got a broken thing and you need to fix it and you can't find the part. You just go to your home 3D printer and you just make the part and everything's going to be great. And how none of that came true. None of it became accessible. I have a really nice new 3D printer over here, and I'm trying to craft these little parts and pieces that can, like, I'm trying to make little camera accessory things that might work. And let me tell you, when you make them out of these, like, plastic filament, and, like, you can kind of prototype some stuff, that's kind of cool. But then I eventually get to a point where it's like, no, this isn't really what's going to make this thing work. And then I just have to go and shop for the real replacement version of that online. And maybe it's because I don't have a nice enough 3D printer. I don't know. But all of this, like Michael is saying, it's like you go through and there's this incredible pressure from shareholders to hear the emotional buzzwords they want to hear. It has nothing to do with the actual performance and profitability of that company. And it's all fake money. I hate it so much. Oh, vulgarity. Yeah. Quote, get big fast. Cory Doctorow being a harbinger yet again. Again, like the most recent Cory Doctorow articles have been pretty spot on. Really depressing stuff. Like in a bad way. Yeah, Dave Burns. Dan Olson's line goes up, really covers the Silicon Valley crew. Only have one trick up their sleeve, and it's move fast and break things. Except that we're now in an era where the breaking stuff doesn't work. And Joe Hickey, before you know it, Planet Earth is a data center for AI. I grieve for the missing voice of Douglas Adams in this kind of world economy. Where, spoilers if you haven't read through the series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but the Earth is not what it seems. And I just wonder what he could have done, that wit, that comedy, that dry, British, sardonic analysis of human behavior in a world where we're radically trying to pace human creativity with these copy, like, again, it's like we're trying to say, oh, well, I've got a computer that can trace Sonic the Hedgehog, and that's the same as drawing Sonic the Hedgehog. And I just feel like Douglas Adams is singularly one of those perspectives that would have eviscerated this current notion of shareholder-driven, profit-motivated consumer abuse. And especially just because I also know that Douglas Adams was also like an incredible technologist. He was such a fan of like buying a new home PC before it was really the cool thing to do. You can kind of see that in a lot of his writings where he's talking about the computer interfaces on an infinite probability drive. You know, like he totally got it. He understood, and that's why it's so funny when he's describing an Android that has become depressed. I just feel like an actual AI depressed Douglas Adams, well ahead of the curve for the future that we find ourselves in today. let me drop through here. Michael Corcoran, what's the name of this 3D printing documentary? Again, I want to find it. I believe it's called Printing the Future. Let me see if it's still on Netflix. Because again, I'm real bad about even finding the movies that I have ripped from my own DVDs on my own Plex server. So let's see, Print the Legend, is that it? Oh, I guess it is. Okay, I had that wrong. It's not Printing the Future. It's on Netflix right now. It's called Print the Legend. And I'm almost positive this is the one I'm talking about because I can see my actual watch time on it. But yeah, so this is a Netflix documentary. When was it made? 2014. 10 years ago, 10 years, 10 years, 10 years, 10 years ago, we were acting like society was going to come apart at the seams because someone had blueprinted the ability to print something that you could put a bullet in and pull a trigger and fire off that bullet. And what are we gonna do? Because that's going to just completely destroy all of the non-existent laws we have on reining in firearms. Actually, the problem is enforcement. We actually do have some good legislation in place already to kind of deal with that. But I'll save that for another political podcast, not this one, as we start looking at trying to wrap all this up. So I guess it's called Print the Legend, not Print the Future. Oh, Malik, actually, that's pretty fair. I think obsolescence killed 3D printing. One part doesn't go out. It all goes out. So it's kind of like a big deal. Like, I've got my 3D printer isn't terrifically expensive. It's a nice, it's the Anchor make. But you do see, like, in the forums, there are a lot of people complaining about, well, this head, now you've got to change out this assembly. You've got to take out the whole little box here and fix all this. And, oh, I woke up this morning and I just have shredded wheat all over my print bed. So, yeah, that's totally fair. Your maintenance for this amazing future of 3D printing is a lot higher than people are accustomed to for a technological gadget that is supposed to simplify your life. That's pretty tough. Bionic Scoop, 42. So funnily enough, we were able to choose Lex's jersey for her softball team, and Marie and I, being nerds, were like, well, yeah, 42, that's the number. Until we got the jersey in, and then I was like, oh, she's got a blue and white jersey with the number 42 on it. She's a little Blanquita Hispanic girl. That actually looks different when we're talking baseball. The number 42 is a different thing when you're talking about softball. But lovely enough, we take her to her first Dodgers game, and I purposely take her up to the reserve section where they've got that kind of hall of Dodgers history. And so I did get a picture of Lex next to one of Jackie Robinson's jerseys, because she's 42, he was 42. She knows why his jersey number, his number is always colored in. So when you go to Dodgers, you always see like these amazing players and Hall of Famers and stuff like that. And all of them are white circles with blue letters, except for Jackie Robinson's, who's a blue circle with white letters. But it was kind of a funny bit on her parents being nerds, not maybe reading the room what that looks like. Little white girl. She's not white, but she's pale. She's like her dad. She's pretty pale. But yeah, so we had to explain to her. We did it because of this, but just in case anyone ever says anything to you about the jersey that you have. And thankfully, she had actually heard the story of Jackie Robinson at school, so it wasn't a tremendous, like, you know, it wasn't like a shock to her. She had already kind of understood it, but still, it was like, you need to know this history if you're going to wear this number. So, oh, Michael Corcoran, my Duo dock was made with a 3D printer, I guess. It's still working perfectly after probably close to 3 years. Yeah, that's pretty cool. From Skrizekzakizwikazol, well, I'm never going to be able to say your name. If you can phonetically write out your Twitch handle so that I can say it properly in a podcast, that'd be great. Can you 3D print a well-working bong? I don't know of anyone who would want to consume materials in plastic. Because you think about what you have to do to make that apparatus that you're describing, and then you apply fire to it, is probably not a good idea. I, for one, don't really love the plastic smell of just melting the plastic. The filament, as it moves through the extruder, that is a type of smell. I don't think I would want that mixed in with any other type of activity that would involve fire and smoke. I think those fumes would probably be real bad for you. Really bad for you. Probably really terrible. And vulgarity. You just got to carry spares of Hitchhiker's Guide to pass out as a quick out for when you're at your softball games. It's like, so why is your daughter 42? And then I whip out a Bible of Douglas Adams stories. And I'm like, hey, read this. The ultimate answer, the question of life, the universe, and everything. So we should probably start wrapping this all up, folks. Stay tuned for some fun videos and things coming to the channel. I've got another article that I'm kind of trying to write up. And I'm also going to be, I think I'm going to be able to get it out this week. I don't know if it'll be a written piece or if it'll be a video, but I just want to take a look back at products like the Google Tablet. The Pixel Tablet has been a really interesting long-term test drive on Google's strategy for expanding Android, for taking a chance on a mixed mode device, something that can be a tablet and a smart display. And while I would still technically chalk it up as not a success, I think it's something that we should probably take a second look at. Just what can we learn from it? So those are some of the like concept pieces that I'm trying to play with in my brain as we're getting ready. The end of this month, beginning of the next month, we're probably going to be starting to talk more about PCs and laptops and some really cool gear there. But also keep an eye out for all of the other really fun channels. We had Joe here in the chat, Joe Hickey from the Nomad Tech Project, Joe and Sam. Podcasting on the regular. Hopefully I'll be joining them for an episode soon. It's been way too long since I had a chance to speak with those fine gents. We had Barry popping in, obviously keep track, and Bionic Scoop. So that crew, make sure you're keeping tabs on Gadget Goddess and Easy Computer Solutions, The Tech Preacher, LaShawn, I'm spacing other names. I said Barry. Who am I missing? Mims? Dang it. So Tuesday's Gadget Goddess, Wednesday's Easy Computer Solutions, Thursday's is Ike's Tech Talk. Ike likes to talk about tech. And obviously TK and I will be joining them there. LaShawn on Fridays. You've got El Jefe Reviews over the weekend. You've just got a crew of really great tech commentators throughout the week. I mean, so much tech happening and talking about some really cool technology stuff. I mean, you'd never really need to watch regular TV ever again. So stay on top of all of that. And of course, it's always greatly appreciated, folks who are catching the replays, reviewing on your favorite podcast platforms or podcast apps and services. And then, of course, the lovely contribution from folks over on my Patreon, patreon.com/somegadgetguy. That community, literally none of my stuff would be possible without their support and without their contributions. And also, the conversations that we have over on the Patreon really do help me move forward on new projects and new videos and new tech topics. So they're the best. So I hope you'll check them out. Folks, I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. Be safe. Take care. I love y'all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.